It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to an investigative reporter about what Wisconsin agencies received military gear as part of a federal program.
First, public health efforts around the country have aimed to lower teen pregnancy rates. While those numbers have been in decline nationally, hitting a record low in 2013, one state's efforts have seen some dramatic results.
According to a recent paper, Colorado cut its teen birth rates by 40% over the last 4 years, bringing national and international coverage to the state's teen pregnancy efforts and raising the question of whether the program could and should be used in other states.
Greta Klingler is with us now. She's the family planning supervisor at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Greta, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Well, the program that's got a lot of credit for lowering teen pregnancy is an effort to provide free and low-cost birth control to teens. Tell us about how it works.
About 6 years ago, we received some additional private funding to supplement what we were already doing in our state family planning program with state and federal funds. The funding we received was specifically to provide long-acting reversible contraceptives like IUDs and implants at no or low cost to all people across Colorado who were interested in receiving these. And this really bolstered the efforts that were already in place, as I said, with our state family planning clinics that offer all contraceptive methods, but due to the high upfront cost of IUDs and implants, had only been able to do that on a really limited basis to begin with.
So was there anything in tandem with the birth control methods themselves? Was there sort of any education and outreach efforts alongside that?
Yeah. So when we first started out, our educational and outreach efforts were really focused around providers, making sure that they were trained both in insertion techniques, but how to counsel and talk to clients about these methods and cover all of the options for birth control in the most effective way. And then as we got into the program and we started seeing, you know, a lot of success just with word of mouth among our clients, once somebody got an IUD, she would tell their friends, her sisters, her mothers, and we would see them coming into the clinics interested as well. But one of the things we heard from both the clients that we serve as well as the providers that work in our clinics was there was a bigger education and outreach piece missing, that people didn't know how to have conversations about sexual health and birth control, whether it was with their partners or their family or their providers. And so we worked a couple years into this overall effort to create the BeforePlay.org campaign, which is a public education effort aimed at getting reliable information out to young people in Colorado about birth control, safe sex, STDs, planning for pregnancy, in a way that was really relatable and accessible to them. So the campaign takes kind of an edgy and funny look at what can be kind of uncomfortable conversations to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to explore that in just a little bit. But first, I'm curious why in this particular effort in Colorado, there seemed to be an emphasis on IUDs and implants versus other methods, like maybe the pill.
Right. So we had seen, you know, pill use high among all of our family planning clients for years, and that's those options with Depo, with the pill, the patch, the ring, have all been more accessible because the upfront cost is lower. Over time, it can add up when you're talking about buying a monthly pack of pills or the ring every 3 months. And with IUDs, you're talking about, and implants, you're talking about anywhere from a $300 to a $900 upfront expense to cover that method. And so at our clinics, we provide services on a sliding fee scale that slides to zero. Most of the clients that we serve don't pay anything for their contraceptive method. And for our clinics, they have to subsidize that cost. And to cover something $900 up front versus maybe a $10 or a $20 pack of pills is a big financial burden, and certainly a big financial burden to the clients that have to pay. And this funding allowed us to offer those methods at the same the same ability as other methods like pills and Depo and things like that. And what we saw is when that cost barrier was reduced, many, many more people chose those methods than had before when cost was more of an issue.
So was this readily accepted by the teenagers in Colorado and their parents, or was there some controversy around it?
You know, we've had a lot of public support throughout this campaign. Our clinics across the state have been around in operation, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 years, and have really established themselves within their communities and have a lot of support. And I think that was a great way to start rolling out this program, was through those existing clinics that had wide acceptance among their communities and at the state level. And we really didn't see a whole lot of pushback from anyone in the state around this effort.
And you saw a 40% decline in teen pregnancies. Were you surprised by how big of a drop there was?
We were. When we first started out with this project, I think everybody expected to see good results. But the rate at which we saw state-level shifts happening, I think, surprised all of us in a very, very good way.
Do you credit it all to this program, or were there other factors involving that decrease?
Well, you look at data nationwide and you see teen pregnancy rates dropping across the country. And so certainly it's a trend that's been going on, and there's multiple factors playing into that. You're seeing kids delay the initiation of sex till later ages, different sex education programs out there supporting it. But certainly we've been able to kind of tease out through looking at the data that we can attribute about 75% of the drop here in Colorado specifically to this increase in access to long-acting reversible contraceptives.
Now, a 40% drop, help us understand in a greater context in the state of Colorado, what does that mean for the economic impact?
It's huge. We're currently working with our state Medicaid office to try and come up with some estimates in terms of actual dollar amounts of what was saved, but we know that teen and unintended pregnancies have huge health, social, and economic impacts, both to the individuals experiencing them as well as the greater community. And so, you know, we see teen mothers have a lower likelihood of graduating from high school or going to college. We see babies that are born as a result of unintended pregnancies are more likely to be born preterm before they're really ready, that there's a higher incidence of low birth weight and other kind of negative health outcomes along the way. And so there's costs associated with all of those things that are being saved when we talk about averting unintended pregnancy and lowering the teen birth rate.
And now this program of supplying birth control to teenagers in Colorado was made possible by an anonymous donor. Do you know what motivated the donation in the first place?
I think they were really looking to see whether an investment at the state level in specifically in promoting use of long-acting reversible contraceptives could have a difference on these health outcomes and kind of long-term impact on this issue. And they, like us, I think, expected to see good things, but I'm not sure anybody expected quite the magnitude. And it's been really wonderful to hear the response from other states and other programs wanting to know exactly kind of the nitty-gritty of how we did things and trying to work in their way to replicate the same efforts to see if they can indeed have the same impact.
Now, I don't know what you know about this anonymous donor, but do you know enough to say whether or not this individual or this group is someone from Colorado, or would they say, oh, that was successful in Colorado, I'm going to donate now to the state of Iowa, I don't know, and take this nationwide?
I can't say their intent moving into the future, but they are not here in Colorado. I can say that.
Interesting. Well, we're talking with Greta Klingler. She is Family Planning Supervisor at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. She's part of a project to prevent teen pregnancy in Colorado.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how this works? Is this something you think Wisconsin should try to replicate? We continue our conversation about teen pregnancy prevention. Greta Klingler from Colorado's Public Health Department is with us now talking about a program in her state that saw a 40% decline in teen birth rate over a four-year span.
You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think teens should have more access to birth control devices? Why or why not? What do you think is important when it comes to preventing teen pregnancy? Let us know at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Greta, earlier you referenced a program in Colorado called Before Play. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
BeforePlay.org is a statewide education and outreach campaign aimed at normalizing the conversation around sexual health and birth control here in the state. And I think what's unique about the campaign is it takes a very different spin than a lot of teen pregnancy prevention campaigns and other messages that we see out there. We really want it to be positive and focused on providing people with the information and the tools to make the choices that are right for them. And for some, it may be choosing to be a parent, but we also want to make sure that all the information is out there and it's accurate and reliable. And we've gotten great response from the young people in Colorado about the campaign, going to the website. And I think one of the great things is we have an outreach team across the state that goes to community events and schools and universities talking about this and engaging people in the conversation and hearing what they need and what their concerns are. And then the campaign works to respond to that and provide them with the tools that they need to make healthy choices and to do what makes the most sense for them.
And as you mentioned, a part of that is to normalize the conversation around sexual health and to foster open dialogue about it. So how do you go about doing that, and how early should parents start?
You know, I think one, it's never too early to be open about conversations about your body and sexuality, and there's a number of great resources out there, I think, for parents on how to start those conversations early and have them, you know, what's appropriate at what ages. Our focus is definitely on kind of the older young people, if you will, from ages 18 to 29 and the tools they need. And on the BeforePlay.org website, there's a great section of conversation starters under the Get Talking heading that helps people look at all different types of kind of categories and topics that they might want to talk about related to sexual health, sexuality, contraception, and gives them different options of how to start that conversation, be it with their partner, with their friends, with a healthcare provider, with their family. And we've heard great things from young people as well as parents that it's been very helpful to them to broach topics that they may not have known how to bring up and that may be uncomfortable. And again, sometimes taking a little bit of a humorous take on it, recognizing that it makes it a little bit easier when you can laugh about it, but still have very serious, informed discussions.
Let's take a call from Jennifer in Milwaukee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. So I was just wanting to say that I think this is an amazing program that you guys are offering, and I wish that they had offered something like that when I was growing up. You know, I'm 28 now, and I have a child now, and, you know, I'm married and whatever, but as I was growing up, I just wish that someone had told me that there was even that kind of an option out there. The only thing that was ever offered to me was the pill, and I sporadically took it and didn't know that there was anything else out there. And I went to college, I'm educated, I'm from, you know, a decent family that should have had those kinds of things talked about, and no one ever said anything. And I didn't even know it existed until I was, you know, a grown woman. And I think that this is so important for teenagers and for anyone, really.
Thanks, Jennifer. Do you have any thoughts on that, Greta?
I do. I think Jennifer brings up a really good point. One, the pill is kind of our default birth control here in this country. Just, it's been around a long time. It's been fairly easily accessible. And there have been a lot of concerns. You know, people from back in the 70s might remember some of the scares with the Dalcon Shield, and then that has kind of brought myths to whether IUDs were safe. And in fact, they are extremely safe. They're extremely effective. And really, they're safe and good choices for almost all women. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, as well as the Association of Pediatricians, have all come out saying that IUDs and implants are great methods for young women, regardless of age, regardless of whether they've been pregnant before. And I think getting that message out, both to providers and the public, is really important. And as more people choose to use these methods, more and more people know about them and know to ask their provider about whether it would be a good option for them. So I think that's a great point. And that idea also that Jennifer said, you know, a lot of people, they take the pill and it's so easy to forget one day. And that one day can then lead to very serious consequences. And so having a method that once you get it inserted, you can forget about, and you don't have to remember something on a daily basis. And in fact, you have to take very conscious steps to have it removed and reversed, is a great option for a lot of young women, as well as women, you know, into their 30s and 40s who want to be able to control that reproductive cycle.
Thanks again for that call, Jennifer. Adam in New London is with us now. Hi, Adam.
Hello. I just had a real quick question. I was wondering if you had seen any adverse effects of this. You're talking about, you know, supplying it to the more of the teenage group, and was wondering if you've seen an increase in, like, STDs or anything like that.
That's a really good question, and it's one we get asked quite a bit. And we actually have not seen any significant change in the STD rates in any of the people we serve. And while a lot of the focus has been on teens, our clinics serve men and women, both of all ages, who are looking to control their reproduction and get educated and get screened and things like that. So we haven't seen any adverse effects there as a result of this.
Well, it does make you wonder if IUDs and implants are the emphasis of this program versus the pill, whether there's an increased amount of unprotected sex happening.
Again, we haven't seen, the data that we have doesn't show that there's been an increase in that. We haven't seen an increase in sexual activity among young people, nor have we seen increases in any of the indicators we would expect with an increase in unprotected sex. So again, STD rates haven't significantly changed. We've seen the teen birth rate go down. We're still waiting on the unintended pregnancy data to come back. So it's a little too early to tell on that, just because there's a lag in when we get the data for that. But we anticipate seeing positive results there as well.
And what's next for this program? Now that you've seen this 40% decrease in teen pregnancies, what more is there to do?
I think, you know, we continue, we've seen the success of making sure that access to these methods is there, and we remain committed to ensuring that access for all women of Colorado who would like to access these methods. So looking at how we can continue the efforts and continue to see the positive health impacts from that is what we're really looking at. And with the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the Women's Health Preventive Service coverage that includes contraception, and here in Colorado, we've been fortunate to expand Medicaid that has a great contraceptive benefit as well. You know, we're looking at how to maximize those resources and make sure people have coverage that they're eligible for, and then making sure that that's utilized to get them the services that they want.
And in our last minute here, in the absence of a major donation to other states, what could other states learn from what you guys have done over in Colorado?
I think one, you know, highlighting the fact that removing the cost barriers is a big piece of that. And with as I mentioned, the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of opportunity there to remove those cost barriers that have been there historically. And then realizing that once it's offered, people do choose this as a method, and it's well accepted. The outcome is extremely positive, and people are very happy and very satisfied with these methods.
Well, Greta, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Greta Klingler. She's a family planning supervisor at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, talking about the state's efforts to combat teen pregnancy.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Farid on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Representatives may be away for their August recess, but things are continuing to heat up for fall elections.
First, we're taking a close look at what agencies in Wisconsin have received military equipment. Records from the state's Department of Military Affairs show that over 67,000 pieces of military equipment have been given to local law enforcement departments in the last 10 years.
The departments got this equipment as part of a federal program that gives military gear to police departments nationwide if the Department of Defense doesn't use it. The program is called 1033.
Here to talk about the program and how Wisconsin agencies have benefited from it is Nick Penzenstadler. He's a reporter for the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, what is this 1033 program?
So this is military equipment that either has reached the end of its military use or is surplus and was never used. And instead of scrapping it and getting rid of it, the military chooses to offer it up through this 1033 program to local law enforcement agencies across the country.
Do these agencies have to pay for it, or is it a donation sort of thing?
They only pay for transportation and then maintenance. So like in the instance of a vehicle, they would pay to transport it to wherever they are, and then they would pay to maintain it, you know, oil changes, that type of thing, but they don't technically own it.
So when we talk about military-grade equipment, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, it's a really wide range. It's everything from night vision goggles all the way up to rifles and helicopters and grenade launchers and even assault rifles.
Now, this is stuff that obviously makes sense if you're talking about the United States military. Why do police departments need it?
Well, the thought is that they're trying to keep pace with a criminal element that has higher powered weapons. Down in Fond du Lac County in December, there was a man who had a 50 caliber sniper rifle that would have, you know, shredded a normal squad car, so they said they needed their armored truck to protect officers responding to that call.
So it's considered to be something police departments need on a case-by-case basis, but not maybe an overarching change in the scope of crime?
Right. I mean, it's free to the department, so they see it as, you know, we can't afford this otherwise, so we should get it now.
Now, you've been tracking this gear over a 10-year period. Where has it gone?
A really wide range, from the really small agencies, like we set up here in Fond du Lac and Outagamie County, and all the way up to, like, the DNR uses some of it. There's a training facility near Volk Field that does a lot of training with this equipment that gets a lot of it, but it's everywhere. It's 219 agencies across the whole state.
So the DNR uses it. Why does the DNR need it?
Well, they mostly get vehicles for, like, a rescue scenario, so they've received over 30 motorcycles that were military-issued, and they use those on forest roads and other hard-to-reach areas, so maybe not so much the weaponry, but more of the equipment.
Is there a particular force department in the state of Wisconsin that has received more of this than others?
Yeah, well, our investigation found that Juneau County was actually top on the list. They're nearly $3 million since the program began, which is mostly vehicles and small equipment, but also they do have a large MRAP vehicle, which seems a little odd given that there's only about 25,000 people that live in Juneau County.
Right. Have you got a sense over this 10-year span whether the police departments who've received this sort of military equipment have actually used it?
A lot of the vehicles and the smaller things, I mean, it goes down to, you know, jackets and boots and you know, pliers, that type of stuff definitely gets used, but I think it's a little debatable whether the combat-ready type equipment gets used, because that's really prepared for either an emergency or a riot or crowd control like we saw in Ferguson, which has obviously brought this to the forefront.
Right, and right now we're looking at closer scrutiny about how militarized police forces should be. Do you see that this sort of reapportionment of military gear is going to come under, you know, a closer look here in Wisconsin, and maybe it's not all going to pass muster.
I think it will. I mean, we've heard President Obama call for a sharp separation between our armed forces and our police departments, and the ACLU is taking a look at this, and I think it's really coming down to oversight, and it's not should these departments have it, but how should they use them and when.
Are you seeing concern among citizens, maybe other agencies, that because police departments have all this military gear now, that they'll be more inclined to use it?
We've definitely seen that. I mean, we had a new military-type MRAP delivered here in Appleton, and people reacted pretty swiftly that they didn't really want to see it unless it was absolutely needed, and they kind of scrutinized whether it was needed in the first place.
Now, MRAP, what is that again?
That's a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle. So they're built really for those roadside bombs that we saw in Afghanistan.
Right. So police are thinking that maybe if you got one of these in your back pocket, it could one day come in handy. Can they give it back, though, if it doesn't, and if the forces that be decide police don't need this kind of militarization?
Yes, and we've seen that a little bit around the country where some city councils, and there's been some citizen drive to give these back, and communities that say we don't want to be a part of this and we want to give it back. We've seen a mix of that in Wisconsin. Some agencies choose to go to the councils and get approval. Others just say we're getting it and we're going to use it.
Well, I imagine you have to store it, you have to maintain it, and you have to train personnel on it. Is some of this military equipment a drain financially?
We haven't really found that. We've heard a lot of people say the costs are very minimal, especially when you consider on like the MRAP side, you know, it's a $700,000 piece of equipment that an agency likely wouldn't be able to afford otherwise, and the routine maintenance is a small price to pay, is what they tell us.
Is part of the legacy here from this military equipment the war on terror, when the United States was in a higher state of alert and police departments were thinking, you never know, this could be something we need?
Sure. Well, it actually goes back even further to the war on drugs in the 90s. And I even heard some local sheriffs referring to the North Hollywood bank robbery where the police were really ill-equipped to handle assault-type weapons. And this was trying to make sure the police were ready to meet that force. But yes, then after 2001, it really accelerated, and we had this focus on making sure we were ready for terror attacks wherever they may come.
Are citizens aware, do you think, that police departments have all of this equipment?
Certainly the more visual things, like the trucks, are easy to see, and it's a big symbol of this. But the really small items are surprising, especially when you look through our database, which we'll be publishing online at Postgres.com and other Gannett sites. It's really mind-blowing how many individual pieces of equipment get transferred.
Now, you've looked at Wisconsin for this investigation. Is it a fair assumption that other states have similar programs?
Yes. Almost every state in the country is taking part in this. It's ballooned to almost $5 billion now of surplus equipment that's been distributed all over. So these agencies individually apply usually to a state agency, and then it goes up to the Pentagon, and it filters down. But just this year, there's been a massive wave of these MRAPs coming back from Afghanistan, or that never got shipped, that local police are using.
Given what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, are you seeing police departments here in Wisconsin who are themselves reflecting on this equipment and being proactive about giving it a look over and seeing whether or not they want it?
Sure. I think we're definitely seeing that consideration. I think police are still weighing the cost-benefit, and they're saying, you know, on that balance, we'd rather protect our, you know, residents and police officers than be in a situation where we really need an armored truck or a piece of equipment that we don't have. So I think you're seeing people think about it, but maybe not change their minds yet.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
That was Nick Penzenstaller, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The House and Senate are still in recess for the rest of August, but the news from the midterm campaign trail continues to flow, and legislators from Wisconsin and around the country are weighing in on topics ranging from the unrest in Ferguson to threats from the Islamic militant group ISIS.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time to give us the scoop on what our representatives are up to in Washington. Paul, great to have you back with us.
Great to be on. How are you all doing?
Good. Well, the protests in Ferguson are continuing to dominate headlines. President Obama made remarks about the situation on Monday, and Attorney General Eric Holder is in Missouri today. How have members of Congress been responding to the shooting and the subsequent protests there?
You know, the interesting thing has been how particularly presidential candidates or potential presidential candidates have been really flying kind of under the radar here. I mean, I think for lawmakers, the only real practical stance at this point is to call for calm and to urge everybody to de-escalate, if that's a word. But they don't want to get in the middle of this conversation about whether the police officer acted inappropriately, whether Michael Brown, the victim here, was engaged in some sort of criminal activity, whatever. It is all best for politicians to simply, you know, pray for America and say, let's all wait and see what the facts show us. Because I think there's a real danger for any politician of getting out in front of this thing and saying something stupid or something that turns out particularly later not to be true.
Or, yeah, look stupid after the fact. But what about those? I can understand maybe the president or maybe a Wisconsin lawmaker not wanting to comment on a situation in Missouri. But what about Missouri lawmakers and the senators there, the representatives there? Do they have more of an obligation and a responsibility to get on the forefront and to try to at least assemble some kind of constructive community dialogue about it?
Well, yeah, but again, part of that is, you know, a lot of the lawmakers, you know, obviously, if you don't directly represent that area, you're going to stay away. And at that point, now the question is, well, what should the governor do about it? What should the state do about it? I think folks have largely supported the governor's decision to send the National Guard there to try and you know, reestablish calm. It looks like maybe that's been a little more successful. Last night was not as bad. You know, I think we are still in a kind of breaking crisis mode. There is not a lot that people can do, but I think there will be a lot of opportunity to talk about, you know, what are the underlying tensions here that are creating this problem in this community. You know, there are a lot of folks asking questions about whether we should still be sending this much military hardware to local police departments. Is that inappropriate? Is it too much? I think we've already seen people promising to introduce legislation or hold hearings to reconsider arming local police departments to the teeth. That kind of stuff on a policy level you can talk about. But I don't think there's a whole lot you can do at this moment in Ferguson.
And do you predict that some of those conversations and those issues will become part of the campaign trail come 2016?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. There will be conversations about, in fact, there's already a petition at the White House with 100,000 signatures on it to, you know, require police to start wearing cameras so that you're always tracking the police activity. You'll see other folks trying to push legislation to, again, you know, reconsider whether we need to be sending this much military hardware to the police. I suspect you'll have a whole series of conversations about, you know, what are the appropriate steps and the required steps for the National Guard and for state responses, this kind of stuff. There'll be a lot of it.
Well, we mentioned last week, moving on now, we mentioned last week that you would be following up on the GOP Senate primary in Alaska that was decided yesterday. So it sounds like former Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan won that primary. Is that what you expected?
Yeah, pretty much. The question was only going to be whether Sarah Palin's endorsement late last week of Joe Miller was going to tip the balance at all. Joe Miller is kind of a Tea Party active kind of fellow, and with Sarah Palin's support in 2010, sorry, I get my years messed up here, he actually beat the sitting Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski in the GOP primary, which was a huge upset. And Lisa Murkowski then, despite the fact that her name is hard to spell, ran a write-in campaign and won the Senate seat back, which is fairly dramatic. So Joe Miller has been sort of wandering around in the wilderness since then, and Palin endorsed him for this race. And the question was whether that would be enough to push him over the top. In the end, it wasn't. Sullivan had all of the establishment Republican money behind him, and he is considered, I think, the tougher candidate for the Democrats to handle in the fall. The Democrats really wanted to run against Joe Miller because they think he's easier to paint as an extremist.
Mm. Well, and the word is that this is one of the races that will decide which party takes the Senate this fall. Now that we know who the Republican contender is, are there any further predictions on who's going to take that seat and what how it might affect the Senate as a whole?
Well, it's a very close race. We expect a very close race between Senator Begich, the incumbent, and Dan Sullivan. We expect that it'll spend historic levels for a Senate race in Alaska. I believe the current estimates have been that $8 million already been spent in this race. And so it is going to be a barn burner. And, yeah, this is one of a half dozen races that will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate next year. There will be an enormous amount of national attention, which is funny because it's a tiny little state, really. You know, there's not a whole lot of people up there. So they have an opportunity to have an outsized impact on the national politics.
Is it drawing a lot of out-of-state money into Alaska?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots and lots. Every major organization, left and right, will be spending a lot of money on. Of course, the challenge with Alaska is there's only so much advertising dollars you can spend. There's only a couple of TV stations. There's not like, you know, what can you do other than, you know, fly people up there and put them on the ground and start knocking on doors and drag them to the polls.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's something that you'll be keeping your eye on throughout the season, and we'll keep checking in on that. On the topic of fall elections, a new USA Today Suffolk University poll found that in North Carolina, 62% of voters in North Carolina see their votes for legislators as votes for or against Obama. What does that tell us about how elections are going to go this fall?
It's a really interesting finding, and I think it speaks particularly for Republicans that, you know, if you can make this race about Obama, if you can make a Senate race about Obama, you are going to paint the Democratic senator or Senate candidate with some of the unhappiness that folks feel about the Obama administration. Obama's popularity is very low to start with, and things have not been going particularly well for the administration recently, and there's still some lingering anger about Obamacare, the health care law. So to the degree you make this a national referendum on Obama, it really works to, we believe, to drive people away from the polls, drive Democratic voters away from the polls. What was interesting also about this thing is that even the Republicans even the Democrats see it as a referendum on Obama. They believe they have to vote for Kay Hagan, in this case, in North Carolina, to support Obama, which is, again, very, very interesting. I think the Democrats in general will benefit from making this a local race, making it about what's best for our state and what's best for the issues on the ground. But it is very clear that for some proportion of the population, they believe, particularly the Democratic-based voter and the Republican-based voter, they believe this is all about voting for the guy who will either support or oppose Obama.
And isn't that the strategy that was taken in 2010?
And in 2010, of course, the advantage was for Republicans in general was this sort of, there's this huge Tea Party wave that everybody was unhappy. Everybody was unhappy with the government, they're taxed too much, the economy was in the tank. So they were able to really nationalize the emotion of dissatisfaction. Of course, the problem is that they unleashed a movement that they can't even really organize themselves. They're having all kinds of trouble with those same people now in Congress, getting them to vote for stuff that they need to pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson is back, and he's in the state for a recess, and he announced that starting today, he will be holding town meetings to warn Wisconsinites about the threat to the U.S. of the Islamic militant group ISIS,
who
we've been hearing about in the news. Some say he's fear-mongering. Others say it's his duty as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. How does this response compare to other members of Congress?
You know, that's the first I've seen. I saw that today. I was like, he seems, honestly, it's a little out ahead of where everybody else is. I mean, I think it is not clear that there is a direct threat to the United States from ISIS at this point. However, it is clear that this is the group that we are most concerned about sort of taking over from al-Qaeda and becoming the real international terrorist group. I would be very interested to see and hear sort of what he offers at these town halls and what kind of suggestions he's making. My suspicion is he's more concerned about Americans traveling abroad than he is about attacks on the homeland here in the U.S., And again, this is a little further out there than I think a lot of the rest of the country is, that our leaders are willing to go to really suggest that we focus on the concern, the direct threat to Americans. But it's clearly this is the new face of international terror that Americans need to be worried about.
And on the other hand, in our last 30 seconds here, is his role on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee giving him some information that maybe no one else has?
It's possible. I'd be more interested to hear what the Intelligence Committee says, but they won't tell us. But sure, I mean, I think the senator obviously has a concern, and I'd be really interested to hear his concern. And the question is, you know, exactly how far that concern needs to go, and does he really think it's time for Americans to panic or just take caution?
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, thank you again for being with us today.
Hey, my pleasure, and have a great day.
You too. We've been speaking with USA Today Politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time with the latest from Congress.